And now it's time to join Anna Hilda Nesset for the second of this week's Late Junctions, dedicated to the music of John Cage, as part of our Cage Centenary Week here on BBC Radio 3.
Night, by silent sailing night, Isabel, wild wood's eyes and primrose hair, quietly all the woods so wild, in mouths of moss and daphne dews, how all so still she lay, 'neath of the white thorn child of trees. Like some lost happy leaf, like blowing flowers stilled, as fain would she anon, for soon again 'twill be win me, woo me, wed me, ah, weary me. Now even calm lay sleeping, night, Isabel, Sister Isabel, Santette Isabel, Madam Isabel, La Belle.
The beautiful and brittle voice of Robert Wyatt singing Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs, an early work by John Cage on a rare LP, released in 1976 on Brian Eno's Obscure label. Welcome to Late Junction with me, Anna Hilda Nesset. For this John Cage week, we're celebrating 100 years since the birth of one of the most influential thinkers and composers of the contemporary era. John Cage called his teacher Henry Cowell an open sesame for new music in America. Cowell pioneered extended playing techniques, for example, plucking the piano strings of a piano and generally to treat conventional instruments in unconventional ways. He talked about the fact that no tone will be pure. Every tone is marked by its environment in some way, the reverberations in a room, for example. Here's a percussion piece by Cowell called Pulse.
Thank you. the age of 12, Merce Cunningham went to study dancing with Maud Leanne Barrett. She was not his first instructor. He had performed in public a sailor's hornpipe at the age of 8. Mrs. Barrett used to say she had 1 foot in the grave and jiggled the other in order to stay out. One day, early in summer, Mr. Cunningham drove over to Mrs. Barrett's to pick Merce up. Mr. Barrett was on the roof doing some shingling. Lucille was in the living room pumping the player piano. Leon was in the dining room practicing basketball. A dog that was out of his mind was running in circles, chasing his tail from one room to the other. Merce and Marjorie Barrett were with Mrs. Barrett in the kitchen, practicing a tap routine. Instead of making his presence known, Mr. Cunningham turned around and went home alone.
Laurie Anderson's Cunningham Stories, using text by John Cage, originally read by John during performances of Merce's dance, How to Pass, Kick, Fall and Run. On the verge of writing his string quartet in four parts, John Cage said to his parents that, without actually using silence, I should like to praise it. The music should also, he says, sober and quiet the mind, thus rendering it susceptible to divine influences. For the next 20 minutes, we'll hear four parts representing each of the four seasons through Hindu imagery of the seasonal cycle. John Cage's string quartet in four parts.
Thank you.
just heard John Cage's string quartet in four parts performed by the Odissi Quartet. Next up, cartridge music, created for one of Merce Cunningham's dances. This piece is from 1960, and the word cartridge here refers to the cartridge of old phonographic pickups. The performer can insert all kinds of small objects into these cartridges, like pipe cleaners and matches and feathers and wires. We're going to hear an extract of cartridge music performed by Takahisa Kasugi, Michael Pugliese and David Tudor.
Thank you.
Formidable and playful piece by the visual artist, improviser and composer Christian Marclay. Jukebox Capriccio, created on the turntable, following on from Cage's cartridge music. In 1944, when John Cage was at Black Mountain College, he made an arrangement of Satie's Socrates. It was made for a dance by Merce Cunningham, but at the time, Satie's publisher wouldn't allow Cage's arrangement to be performed. So to solve the problem of the dance performance, Cage then composed what he called cheap imitation, which uses most of Satie's rhythmic and phrase structure, but subjects the pitches to chance operations. Before we hear cheap imitation, here's the first movement of that original arrangement of Socrates, as performed by Aki Takahashi and Ivan Mikishov.
Thank you.
cheap imitation performed by Stefan Schleiermacher, following on from Cage's original arrangement of Satie's Socrat. The literary critic Frank Kermode interviewed John Cage in 1970 about art, life, copyright issues and the I Ching.
Sounds are not people. They are, as people and other things in the world, central to their own experience. So that all of nature is a multiplicity of things, each one of which is at the center of the universe. This is an Oriental idea. And that these centers are then in interpenetration and hopefully non-obstruction. That would mean that a sound is a sound rather than that it's the servant of a human being. Therefore, each one of us is able to hear a sound freely in his own way, and this interests me more than, so to speak, using sounds to express some idea in my head which itself is not sounds.
This means, presumably, that whereas a composer of an older kind felt that he had to suggest some kind of pattern of relationships between the sounds he used, you no longer feel that to be part of your task, then how would you define your task as a composer?
Well, first I would assume that relations exist between sounds, as they would exist between people, and that those relationships are more complex than any that I would be able to prescribe. So that by simply dropping that responsibility of making relationships, I don't lose the relationships. I rather keep the situation in what you might call a natural complexity that can be observed in one way or another. Now, ordinarily, one thought that the function of the artist was to express himself, and therefore he had to set up particular relationships. I think that this whole question of art is a question of changing our minds, and that the function of the artist is not self-expression, but rather self-alteration. And the thing being altered is clearly not his hands or his eyes, but rather his mind.
John, where do these relationships exist? Where do you study them? In nature or in the minds of the people who are perceiving them?
Given a particular situation, one person will observe certain relationships, another will observe others. Now, if we have the view that we used to have, that there was only one right way of observing the relationships of things, then we have a situation that really doesn't appeal to me. We have, in other words, one thing that's right and all the rest are wrong. I would like to have a multiplicity of rights. And then there's a further thing that comes in here, and that is what we might call life instead of art. That is, while we are listening to a piece of music or looking at a painting, inevitably things outside the object of music or the object of painting, inevitably those things intrude, for instance, shadows, lights, whatnot on a painting, sounds of people coughing or cars passing by in the street outside come into connection with a piece of music to which we may be listening. If we see art as opposed to life, or life as opposed to art, then we will find those shadows and those ambient sounds interruptions. But if we engage in what I spoke of as self-alteration, we will see those not as interruptions, but as enrichments. Just the other day, I had the experience of listening to a piece of mine that was on a record, the string quartet I wrote in the late 40s. And while I was listening to it, I noticed sounds of insects and of traffic. I was in the country, superimposing themselves on the sounds of the record. And I couldn't help at one point wishing that I had written some of the sounds which were actually simply happening.
You don't have to write them. They're all around. Presumably what you have to do is create a situation in which they are attended to.
True. So I wouldn't say that we are interested in destroying the barrier between art and life, or even blurring it. I would say that we are interested in observing that there is no barrier between the two.
Would it be better, I mean, to abandon the art and life distinction and say that what you're looking for is that people should pay the kind of attention that they normally reserve for what's labelled music, you know, and therefore rather grand, that they should pay this kind of attention to other sounds which seem to you equally interesting?
True. I'm in perfect agreement with that.
I know you've used various ways of achieving randomness, that is to say, avoiding the imposition of your own local ideas of order on what you're doing. You've used dice, you've used the E-King, and now I believe you use computer for this purpose.
I use the computerized E-King. Now that I have arthritis, it's difficult for me to toss three coins six times and do that tens of thousands of times, which is necessary in the case of an extended work. So that I have the process of the E-King computerized, and I have a large stack of printout, which I use for any work that I have to do. Then I make a series of questions, Frank, which is what computer programming is, and I relate all numbers to the number 64, which is basic to the E-King, and then I'm able to know from a collection of possibilities which one I'm to use.
What would be the difference between your doing this and somebody else doing this? I remember Duchamp said that his random is not anybody else's random, it's all his. Is your random totally impersonal, or is it cage random?
I try to make it impersonal. I would like to separate myself from these events, whether they're of sound or whatnot, so that they can be themselves rather than being me.
You want to get right out of the whole operation, in fact.
Yes, I would like to live my life and let my sounds live their lives.
In other words, if other people knew how to do it, they could do it just as well as you.
I should think so.
But you've had to learn how to do it, and of course the way you do it is affected by your own predilections and your own...
Well, I've also had a good deal of experience, and I've not tried to keep this a secret. I've generally explained all the various things that I've done. Even though I'm opposed, for instance, to copywriting as a principle of ownership, nevertheless, I copyright everything I do, because at the present time it's necessary for me to make a livelihood. It's symptomatic of the present social situation, which extends from conventions of the past and which overlaps what I would call this new view, which is beginning. Our lives are full of contradiction at the present time.
Thank you.
John Cage spent a year lecturing at Darmstadt, where he spent time with Karlheinz Stockhausen and Pierre Boulez. And there you heard the work of the three composers back to back. An excerpt from Pierre Boulez's Piano Sonata No. 2, and before that, Stockhausen's Klavierstücke No. 4. And starting up that sequence was John Cage's Music of Changes No. 1. Now here's another interpretation of Cage, the rock group Sonic Youth, getting to grips with Cage's piece 6.
Thank you.
That was Four Systems by Earl Brown, who was one of Cage's colleagues in the New York School of Composers from the mid-50s with Morton Feldman and Christian Wolff. And that recording was made by the legendary sound artist Max Neuhaus. This is Late Junction, part of Radio 3 Centenary Week, and there's still time to listen to last weekend's Music Matters about how Cage's music and ideas developed throughout his life, including interviews with Christian Wolff, David Berman and others, and you can find that by going to the Radio 3 website. Join me tomorrow for an exclusive recording of the eccentric happening that is Musi Circus, recorded at the ENO in London earlier this year. To end tonight, though, here is John Cage's music for Marcel Duchamp, performed by Magne Hegdahl. Good night.
Welcome from me, Jonathan Swain. This is Through the Night here on BBC Radio 3, another of Through the Night's piano fests for this couple of hours. And the pianists, Team GB, you could say, Gwilym Simcock, Clear Williams, Ashley Wass and Ben Grosvenor. This first of them, Peter Donohoe, a recital he gave at London's Queen Elizabeth Hall in February 2012. Late Brahms in his programme and Liszt in Switzerland. But he opens with Debussy, his Estampe, three evocations of the natural world in different moods, translated into sounds that had never been heard before Debussy gave them voice. The second of them, Evening in Granada, Manuel de Falla said was the most evocative musical picture of Spain he knew. And before it, Pagodas.
Thank you.
picture of the British summer, Jardins sous la pluie, Gardens in the Rain, the third and last of Debussy's Estampes, the set played there by Peter Donohoe at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in February 2012. Donohoe now in this recital in late Brahms, a set of six pieces, most of them intermezzos, which Brahms sent to Clara Schumann on his birthday, a rather strange idea she thought shouldn't have been her giving him a present. Anyway, by then Clara was nearing 75 and not up to playing the more strenuous.